This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We hear a lot about the amount of debt many students take on while attending college. But how many of those schools are making sure those students know how to deal with that debt or even understand it once they graduate?
The programs have to be geared toward where they are, understanding student debt, credit cards, automobile loans, understanding what you have to think about if you're going to rent, things of that nature.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about one Northeast school that now mandates courses in financial literacy for all of their students. We'll also spend an academic minute trying to find a little financial sense in the cost of health care in the U.S. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Four years ago, the U.S. economy pretty much imploded, and most of us learned just how little we actually knew and understood about the ins and outs of our financial system. Hey, it's been 4 years, and a lot of us are still treading water with that stuff. But for a college student just entering the workforce and the financial playground, the need for understanding is huge, especially if they're carrying a load of student loans and credit card debt. We recently learned about one school that's doing something about the problem. Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont, is one of the only schools in the country that mandates students take courses and seminars in financial literacy in order to graduate. Here to talk about the program is John Pelletier, the director of the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College. We spoke recently, and I asked what was meant by financial literacy.
Well, to me, financial literacy is the ability to give yourself a lifetime of financial well-being. So it's the ability to have the right knowledge, behaviors, to make good decisions so that you can hopefully make choices that give you a comfortable lifestyle, or as comfortable a lifestyle as you can given your income level.
In the past, you had to worry about, you know, having enough cash, a checking account, maybe a car loan. Now there is so much out there, from credit cards to student loans to having to plan your own retirement. This really is something that's important now, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Particularly, you know, when you look at this younger generation going through colleges and high schools right now, what's happening to me, what's happening that I think is such a problem is we've totally changed our retirement system. If you go back to the 1950s and 60s, many people graduated with a pension. I mean, with a guaranteed check month in and month out, plus Social Security. We've gotten rid of, for most people, other than some very large corporations and people who work for the government, pension plans. And pension plans are being replaced by defined benefit plans. And what that means is the quality of your retirement, your ability to have a solid retirement, is based upon two things. One is you have to save. You have to make that decision in the workplace. If, by the way, you're lucky enough to have a 401k or 403b plan, and maybe 40% of Americans don't even work someplace where they are offered such a thing. But if you do, you have to put money away from your salary each and every month into these 401k plans. And when you switch jobs, you've got to roll them over either into an IRA or into another plan. So not only do you have to save, it's not being done for you in some sort of automatic basis as part of your employment contract like a pension is. Not only do you have to save, but then once you do save, you've got to become a portfolio manager and figure out what should I invest it in? How do I grow that nest egg? And I think that's a fundamentally different place where we are today than where we were years ago.
Yeah, at least everybody has to have some kind of working knowledge of the stock market, at least.
At least a basic level of understanding of how market works and diversification and risk. So, you know, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. You want some portion of your savings in money market, some portion in bonds, some portion in equities. And frankly, things have changed. That, you know, again, going back to the 50s and 60s, you know, we were the dominant economy with virtually all stock market capitalization globally being here in the United States, you know, through Wall Street. Well, today, when you look at economic growth is coming predominantly from emerging countries right now. And so as economies are, you know, that are growing incredibly fast, look at China in our lifetime, right? You have countries like that that are growing tremendously fast. You need a portfolio that is diverse not only among asset classes, but it needs to be diverse globally. So you don't want to put all your eggs in one country basket either.
Are you finding that students are already coming in a bit more savvy than in the past?
No, they're not coming in more savvy. I think I would say they're coming in more receptive. I think they've seen what has happened to their parents. Think about it this way. The folks that came in the class of 2008, they graduated last May. So the kids who came in literally in the fall when Lehman Brothers collapsed, if they were four-year seniors instead of five- or six-year seniors, they graduated. I certainly have met some students where the understanding they had with their parents changed. The percentage of money that they were expected to contribute either through work or student loans increased materially because their parents' income dropped. I know of one young man whose father was in the construction business, and their original deal when he went in was sort of a 50-50 split. Well, that changed dramatically because his business changed dramatically. So I think, you know, when you look at the data that is out there, people have had tremendous pain from this great recession we've gone through. I'll give you one example. Think of just home equity. To the extent that parents were tapping into their home equity to help they pay for college, in 2007, the median amount of home equity was $110,000. So on average, not everybody, but you know, kind of the median, the biggest area on a curve, had economic value over and above their mortgage of $110,000. Well, that dropped to $75,000 in 2010, and probably hasn't gone up much higher than that. And that's according to, you know, the Federal Reserve Consumer Finance Review. People lost a lot of net worth. So when you add home equity and stock, the median net worth from the Great Recession from 2007 to 2010, median net worth dropped 40%. I mean, that's huge. Now, it's gone up a little bit, particularly for folks. A lot of their money invested in the market. But the big change for everyone has been this economic hit. And so the kids are coming in, and I think they're much more attuned to the fact that they could get into financial trouble like their parents. And I think they're much more receptive to the conversation, even though they may not be more knowledgeable.
Well, let's talk about what's going on in Champlain. What types of classes and seminars are being required?
Well, you know, what we do, it's an interesting program. We have something called the LEAD program, L-E-A-D, Life Experience and Action Dimension Program. And the president of the college, Dave Finney, had a vision that I just fully support and embrace, that when you go to college, and, you know, you're taking your core requirements and you're taking your major classes, you miss something that he thought every student should have, 21st century life skills that you need to have to be successful. And those fell into a variety of categories, things like, you know, professional skills, how to look at yourself as, you know, building your own personal portfolio to promote yourself to get a job, you know, looking at not a job but a career, and how do I have a career and manage my career, community involvement, you know, making sure that, you know, the students are at least participating to some extent in being involved in the community that they live in, and what we call financial sophistication. So the program is set up that there are elements that students must go through every year, but it's non-credit hours. So then the question is, well, gee, how do you have the students do that? It's not a credit hour thing. How do you have the students do that? The way we set it up is there are certain things they must do every year, or they can't register for classes the next semester. So they're non-credit hour mandatory seminars or activities that must be completed all 4 years of college.
And how many of these do they have to go through each semester? How long are they?
Well, let's focus on financial sophistication. So on the financial sophistication front, the way we're structuring it is, as you know, we've been playing with it a little bit this year, we're waiting for a national test that we can tap into that'll be available soon. But what we want to do is, even before the students show up, test them and find out what do they know. And more importantly, we want to test them their senior year when they graduate on personal finance topics. The other thing we want to do is have them take the opportunity to take a variety of seminars. We require about 2 to 3 hour seminars over 3 years on topics. But what we find is the topic has to be relevant to where they are in their life. I'll give you an example of one of the ones that I'm involved with that is pretty much, it's when I teach it, it's usually maybe 35, 40 seniors in the room at a time. And it's pretty much always seniors because the topic is what's in it for me, understanding my employee benefits. So it's making them understand the economic value of benefits, how expensive they are, things like health care. Many of them are amazed how much a standalone policy that has decent bells and whistles will cost them if they don't get it through the workplace. So we go through that, make sure they understand that. And I spend, frankly, an awful lot of time explaining to them how they could be a millionaire by investing when they're young, because they have something you and I don't have, which is decades and decades of years to invest in, to see their money double every decade if they can get about a 7% return on their savings, and explaining the power of compound interest and how that works. So that would be an example. The freshmen, we have this great thing we do, which is we call it the game of life. We have the students come in, and based on their major, and many of the students that show up have already designated a major, we give them a job with a very realistic starting salary based on Bureau of Labor Statistics for something in their major. And we have booths set up, and they have to go around, and they have to acquire and determine how much they're going to spend going out on a regular basis. What's their mode of transportation? How are they going to live? How are they going to clothe themselves? And, how many personal electronic devices are they going to need, and all those sorts of things? And they make all these decisions, and the people running the booth's job is to make them buy the most expensive package. And at the end, they have to go and go through an accounting to see whether or not they, would be bankrupt. Would they even be able to live within their means if they took everything? And frankly, many of them need to go back and decide what they're going to give up or what they're going to change. So the programs have to be geared toward where they are, understanding student debt, understanding credit, and particularly credit cards, automobile loans, understanding what it's like, what you have to think about if you're going to rent. What do you need, including, insurance on your contents and things of that nature. So what doesn't work with people in this age category would be a class on very involved retirement investing, as opposed to just getting them into the concept of saving and understanding the power of compound interest. What doesn't work is let's talk about a mortgage. You've got to get them where they are and where they live and topics that are relevant to them today. And that's true, by the way, with all personal financial education at any age level. If you want to make an impact with someone about a mortgage, get that person just as they're ready to buy their first house. You'll be very impactful because they'll be receptive to the information.
Still to come, our conversation with John Pelletier, the director of the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont, continues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1190. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is John Pelletier, the director of the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont. We're talking about Champlain's policy of mandating students take courses and seminars in financial literacy in order to graduate. And I asked him if the program has been going on long enough to see any concrete results.
Yes. What we're doing at Champlain, there's the student aspect of it, which is one element of what we're doing. in all honesty, I don't think that's been going on long enough because we're tweaking it as we go along. And it only really started in 2010. So in the 2010-11 academic year, we rolled out the financial sophistication program. The other thing the college does, or what I do and spend a lot of my time focused on, is with regard to teacher training. We have a program, and it's been recognized by the White House in a report this past May as well. We're one of the few places in the country where we're focusing on building a 3 master's credit hour course that we deliver to educators. So think K through 12. Because, you know, one issue that's really important when you think about this, and we forget, you know, those of us who live in communities where 80%+ of the kids go on to college, that more than half of all students are never going to go to college. Their last chance to get personal finance education is high school. And even the students that go on to college, you know, the college completion rate is not that high. It's below 60%. So, you know, when you look at the number of people, even though many of us deal in our everyday life with people that have college degrees, it's actually a fairly small number of young people today, probably, I'm guessing, around 40% that you would expect to have a 4-year college degree at most. So if you're really worried about personal finance, it's great that we're doing something with the students that are coming to Champlain College. But what I'm focused on is trying to build a program nationally of teacher education in the K through 12 arena. And what we've discovered, there was a great study that was funded by the National Endowment of Financial Education in 1989. And what they did is they did a survey of, I think it was close to 2,000 teachers, people training to be teachers, and people who are training the teachers. And what they found is that more than 2/3 of the teachers felt unqualified to teach personal finance education in the classroom. And less than 20% of the teachers reported feeling very competent to teach any one of 6 personal finance topics, okay? And those topics were things like savings and investing, risk management and insurance, credit and debt, planning and money management, income and careers, financial responsibility, and decision making. And the real issue is when you look today, there are only 4 states in the country, according to the Jumpstart Coalition, that require a standalone 1-semester course in personal finance as a high school graduation requirement. And more than half of the states don't really require anything at all. So when this is being taught in America today, in a high school setting, it's usually being taught as an elective, which means, by definition, not everybody's getting access to it. So even if you waved a magic wand today and every high school was required to have a course on personal finance, the teachers need to be able to teach it. And so we've been part of a national pilot project in 5 states where we're providing teacher training. To the best of my knowledge, we're one of only 3 places in the country where a teacher can get a master's degree credit and be taught not only the topic matters that they need to understand, which are, frankly, many of them find useful in their own life, but more importantly, they're taught how to bring it effectively into the classroom. And probably, you know, you were saying, is there any statistical data? We've done this with 60 teachers over the last 2 years as part of this beta program. And one of the questions we ask all the teachers before they come to the class is, I have the knowledge necessary to effectively teach my students about personal finance. And before the class, more than half of them were either neutral with regard to that statement, disagreed, or strongly disagreed. 10% strongly agreed, meaning they felt only 10% said, you know, I could really do this well. And about maybe another 38% said, you know, I think I could do this well. And interestingly, about 80% of the teachers involved in this were already teaching it. Well, when they leave, after they take that intensive 45-hour boot camp we put them through in a single week, you know, where we have literally access to 26 different instructors over 5 days, when they leave, 93% strongly agree or agree with the statement that I now have the knowledge necessary to effectively teach this in my classroom. So to me, that's moving the needle. And I believe that this should be taught in the classroom. The other thing that's interesting is, you know, we talk about this as though it's something new. If you go back and look at the mathematics textbook, the most popular mathematics textbooks used in the country at the turn of the last century, so the late 1800s through about 1940, the textbook used is embedded with mathematic problems that are based on what you and I would consider personal finance. So there was a time in our nation, and it went away in 1950, there was a time when teaching mathematics, you know, basic mathematics, you know, pre-algebraic mathematics, had a lot of personal finance data attached to it.
John Pelletier is the director of the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont. You can learn more at champlain.edu. One thing that always puts a strain on our ability to be financially stable is the high cost of health care. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. When it comes to health care, the United States spends significantly more per citizen than other industrialized countries. But as Prabhjit Singh of the Earth Institute at Columbia University explains, that doesn't mean we can't learn from countries where little is spent.
Imagine this. You're a parent in rural sub-Saharan Africa and your child has a fever. Rather than embarking on a potentially long and dangerous journey to a clinic or hospital, often miles away, a trained member of your neighborhood quickly arrives to assess their sickness. This person can immediately address common problems while saving time, expense, and concern. Across underserved areas where doctors and nurses are scarce, community health workers are already a vital link between household and health systems. In Tanzania, for example, the ratio of doctors to patients is about 1 for every 27,000 people, and in many places, finding a doctor or nurse is simply impossible. UNICEF reports that 2/3 of child deaths there are due to preventable causes, including malaria, pneumonia, diarrhea, malnutrition, and some infections. Armed with protocols, rapid diagnostic tests, and a small number of medicines and mobile phones, community health workers are making appropriately supported decisions that save lives. For example, for a child with fever, a worker can confirm a case of malaria with a rapid diagnostic test, and if positive, administer the proper medicine while alerting a clinic for follow-up support. We have seen this firsthand across the Millennium Villages Project, a locally managed, UN-supported approach that has shown that one community health worker for 1,000 people is affordable. The system costs $6 per person served each year in the context of a basic primary health care system. Even though community health workers have been around for 40 years in countries as varied as Brazil, Nigeria, and India, the convergence of management systems, diagnostic, and mobile technology is minting a new generation of community health systems. The amazing story is that the same techniques that are making community health workers the heroes of health in the developing world are spreading to new organizations in communities like East Harlem, New York. This is an incredible example of developing countries leading the way for the developed, helping build stronger, more supportive communities for everyone.
That was Prabhjit Singh of Columbia University's Earth Institute. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.